in Chatham.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Amen. 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 Sing it over. Amen.
That's Sidney Poitier leading a chorus in the 1963 film Lilies of the Field. At the Oscars that year, 1963, Sidney Poitier walked away with an Academy Award, becoming the first African-American to win the award for a leading role. It's nearly 40 years later, and no black actor has followed him onto the podium for that top honor. On March 24th, for the first time, three African-American actors, Denzel Washington, Halle Berry, and Will Smith, are up for Best Acting Oscars. The roles that got them nominated are far cries from Mammies Who Don't Know Nothing About Birthing Babies or Step and Fetch It-style stumbling sidekicks. But exactly how far have black Americans come in Hollywood? And how far can they go in a Hollywood dominated by white money and a white majority filling the theaters? Tonight, black actors on the silver screen do three big nominations in 1 year. Mark a shift from a century of stereotypes and invisibility. How have the roles available for African Americans changed in front of the camera and behind? How far have we come, and how far do we still need to go? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio is Garen Daly, On Point's movie maven, who is a film analyst and reviewer and owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Garen Daly. And we're joined from New York by Dr. Jesse Algeron-Rhines, a professor of political economy in the African American and African Studies Department at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. He's author of Black Film, White Money. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Jesse Rhines.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Good to have you with us. Let's just start this hour off with a little sound from Gone with the Wind, that old classic. And here's the famous scene in which Butterfly McQueen, as Prissy, tells Scarlett she won't be able to help with obstetrics.
Prissy, you've got to manage without the doctor. I'll help you.
Oh, Lordy, Miss Scarlett!
What is it?
Lordy, we've got to have a doctor. I don't know nothing about birthing babies.
What do you mean?
I don't know.
You told me you knew everything about it.
I don't know how come a tell such a lie. Mine never let me around. We both was having them.
That scene from Gone with the Wind, and the whole movie is really a kind of baseline for movie race relations in many ways. Hattie McDaniel won Best Supporting Actor Oscar as Mammy in that film. Jesse Rhines, how far have we come?
Well, I guess that there are a lot of ways of looking at it. At that time, most of the films that people saw in theaters were actually made by whites. That means white producers, white directors, mm-hmm. and, of course, white actors. And you had a sprinkling of roles for blacks, particularly because of the coming of the sound industry, not long before when blacks had been singing in white films.
Mm-hmm.
But today, we have more people who are beginning to work behind the cameras in addition to people who are working in front of the camera. One of the things that was happening at that time, we did have some filmmakers. Oscar Michaud got a few films out in that period. He had stopped working for a while but then came back. He was really the dean of the African-American film industry because by hook or by crook, he actually made films and sometimes bicycled them from theater to theater to market them. And in some cases, we're still in that mode. Sometimes you have to carry a film under your arm order to get it for a theater. That's right.
Like Spike Lee financing his first films on credit cards.
That's Spike and Robert Townsend doing that. Yeah, it can be still very hard, but we are seeing more people. In fact, in the latest issue of Savoy magazine, the cover story is the Hollywood issue, and Samuel Jackson is on the cover. And it does a very good overview, I think, of what's happening in the industry, both in front of the camera and behind the camera.
Mm-hmm. Garen Daly, we want to bring things right up to date tonight, but we want to understand where this whole legacy of both race representation, how African-Americans were represented in films, and the very roles that African-Americans have had in films and in film. We want to look at both tonight. it's got a long history.
It's got a long history. It's a huge history, and it's enormous when you try to put your hands around it and grab it. But I think starting with Gone with the Wind is a good way to start, because in that film we've got Prissy, who plays this very simple, almost childlike character, which was a stereotype that you saw in movies. And then you had Hattie McDaniel trying to bring something special to the role as Mammy. She did win an Oscar for this, but she also ended up almost being ostracized by her own community for doing that. She never got another good role other than that.
It must have been a bittersweet honor, because here she has the Oscar, but she's played the absolute classic down on the plantation kerchief mammy role. That's not where people were wanting to go.
That was not where people wanted to go, and there was a real backlash within the community. And
within
the black community, there was actually picketing, and people sent her nasty telegrams and things like that. But as she said at that time, I would rather play a maid rather than being a maid. And again, in other films, like even in Imitation of Life, which is in the early mid-30s, Louise Beavers and Claudette Colbert are buddies, white, black. They have a daughters, white and black. But there's a problem that exists between them, because one of the daughters, the white daughters, is kind of mean. And here's a clip from that.
Let's listen.
You apologize to Piola this minute.
No, Miss B. Don't make an apology. Ain't no good at that.
You, it's 'cause you're black. You make me black. I won't be black.
Jesse, how could you say such a mean, cruel thing to Piola?
I didn't mean anything.
Oh, it ain't her fault, Miss B. It ain't yours and it ain't mine. I don't know rightly where the blame lies. It can't be our laws. It's got me puzzled.
The 1934 Imitation of Life, and there Piola's mother comforts her after her white friend has teased her for being black. Jesse Ryan's, what a great film that was, and of course remade in the 50s, but wrestling directly with the issue of the cost, the burden of blackness in America.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about that film is you did have a white woman and a black woman living supposedly as co-equals in the same household. They had entered a business relationship together, expecting to make profits, using the maid's recipe for pancakes. The Claudette Colbert character built a company to sell pancakes throughout America. They got a house together, and there's one really great scene where it comes time for them to go to bed. They're in the same room, and there's been some comforting going on. And at the end, you see the white woman walk up the stairs and the black woman walk down the stairs. There were two completely separate roles, except where necessity was taking place in that. And you know, like this question of the separate roles. I mean, remember, we've had separate theaters for blacks and whites, even when blacks and whites, up until probably the 50s in many places, attended the same theaters. Blacks had to sit in one area, whites had to sit in the preferred areas. So this is something that has happened for a long time, and I do not know whether or not that is still on the table for many blacks. There is a rising trend toward nationalism in this country, because things have actually gotten worse for blacks overall. There are a few people who are in the middle class who look like they are moving ahead, but the poor have gotten poorer. They've been pushed further to the margins in America. And this separation is very, very serious. I do not know whether or not blacks are going to continue to be happy with the slow pace of change in the United States for the overall black community.
And if blacks are not, that will undoubtedly show up on the silver screen, this dialectic between America's real-life struggle with racial issues and Hollywood's depiction of racial issues has always gone on, hasn't it, Gary?
It has. And again, you know, when you're looking back and back into the 30s, you know, we saw in Imitation of Life two women working out a relationship, a white woman and a black woman. And you also had cases where you had black men and a white man working out their relationship. And one of the best actors of the 30s was Paul Robeson. And in the film Jericho, he is a soldier on a troop ship, and it's torpedoed, and he rescues six people. But in the process, another officer was killed accidentally, and he's brought to trial. And here we're going to hear a clip where you hear the paternalism of Hollywood coming towards a black man. And this black man, remember, is Paul Robeson, very powerful man.
Let's listen.
Before you go on, sir, I'd like to tell you a few things about Corporal Jackson.
That is an order.
I've known Jackson for many years, sir. At college, he had an excellent record as scholar and athlete. And as a soldier, his conduct has always been exemplary. Another thing is, sir, he's very popular with the men. So the moral effect on the Negro troops of prosecuting Jackson for an essentially heroic act would be, well, it'd be very bad, to say the least. It seems to me, sir, that Sergeant Gamey lost his head in a crisis, or he wouldn't have ordered Jackson to abandon his attempt to rescue the imprisoned men, which he actually did. He saved several lives.
Your opinions, Captain Mack, though commendable, are evidently biased, and I'm not in agreement with them. Discipline must be maintained, and I have no alternative but to recommend the arrest of Corporal Jackson for murder.
There it is, a scene from Jericho, 1937, where Paul Robeson gets slapped right down. Paul Robeson, excuse me. Jesse Rines, when you look at what Hollywood is putting out today, have black actors and actresses achieved a co-equal status with the white actors on the screen?
I think that there's some really interesting things that are happening right now. You are seeing black characters in roles in Hollywood, and they're actually playing black characters. Mm. This is not like the days when Sidney Poitier was one black person in a whole sea of white people. He had no love relationship. He had no friends. It was just him with a bunch of white nuns. I don't see that as a very fulfilling experience. Mm. But, you know, like we've recently had Training Day with Denzel Washington, which he's played a fully realized African-American character, somewhat vile, admittedly.
Jesse, this is Garen here. You know, I think with that particular role, he plays really against type. You know, Denzel has always been playing a really good guy, an honorable guy, and in this one, he's playing against type. He's playing a really nasty Machiavellian guy, and I think that's why he's being, I think one of the reasons that he's up for the Academy Award is because it's against type.
Denzel Washington is maybe one of the most interesting black actor in this regard, Jesse Rines. He seems to be able to push into more areas of cinema than almost any other well-known black actor working today, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that he is able to do that. He's a really good actor. I saw the other film that he's in that's out now.
John Q?
John Q. And even though the papers have panned it, I really liked that film. It brought a tear to my eye.
What's his role there, Jesse Rines?
And he is a father whose son will die very soon if he doesn't have a liver transplant. And because of the HMO he has, they refuse to pay for the liver transplant. Mm-hmm. So he takes a group of people in the hospital, holds them hostage until his son is put on the donor list for the transplant.
Give us a little psychoanalysis here, Jesse. Why does Denzel Washington play so well in all racial camps? He's a great actor. Is there something beyond that in the way he approaches roles?
Well, I hear a lot of women say he's a good-looking
guy.
Well,
yeah, that has been noted.
I'm a guy, and I would say he's good-looking, too. You know? Yeah,
that has been noted.
He's also really, really cool. I mean, when you look at Denzel Washington, and he crosses against those demographic lines. But, you know, one of the problems that any black actor is going to have is, let's assume that you are a producer of a Hollywood film, and you are going to put up $40 million for a film, and you want Denzel Washington to be your star. The problem is when you start looking at his romantic involvements, because is he going to have a white woman or is he going to have a black woman? Mm-hmm. And that is when producers start getting scared because they're afraid of that interracial mix. And that's where a lot of projects are pulled away from Denzel. And here's a quote that I found on Denzel. There is a ceiling for black actors, no doubt about it. I mean, I'm not getting dozens of roles at my door either, but I'm trying to keep thinking of it as a glass ceiling, one that can be broken at some point.
There's Denzel Washington ready to break the glass ceiling. We're going to come back and talk about movies in which even that sexual barrier gets crossed and what they've meant. We're talking about black actors in film. Do three Black Academy Award nominations in 1 year mean it's a new day? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've got three great black actors up for leading awards in the Academy Awards this year for Best Actor, Best Actress Awards. Denzel Washington, Halle Berry, Will Smith. Does that mean it's a new day in the way black actors can access the business of Hollywood, the screens of America, and the minds of Americans? We're joined tonight by Dr. Jesse Algeron-Rhines. He's author of Black Film, White Money, teaches political economy in the African-American and African Studies Department at Rutgers University, and by On Point's resident movie expert, Garen Daly. He owns the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. You're welcome as well. How far have black actors come in the roles they play? How far has Hollywood come in opening to black America? And does a Hollywood sex scene with Halle Berry and Billy Bob Thornton a revolution make? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jesse Rhines and Garen Daly were talking about Denzel Washington's remarkable capacity to move around the film world before the break. Garen, you were saying that in a way he's an echo of Sidney Poitier, but as Jesse said, he's a distant echo. Sidney was much more hemmed in, wasn't he?
Well, he was hemmed in, and he was more than willing to admit it. Like an even in Guess Who Coming to Dinner, he said that was the best that Hollywood could do at that time. And even in Lilies of the Field, most people don't realize he won an Academy Award for that, but that was not a major Hollywood production. It was shot in 14 days. The director put up his house to finance the film. This is more of an indie film that seemed to have reached a little bit of a crest and touched into something that was really strong in America.
So it snuck in behind or around the Hollywood machinery.
And I think part of it was it may have been payback for The Defiant Ones, a Stanley Kramer film, mm-hmm. where Sidney Poitier is literally chained to Tony Curtis as they mm-hmm. escape from a chain gang. It's
a
wonderful film.
I think we have
film.
Some of that. Let's listen to a little bit of The Defiant Ones, 1958.
Come on, let's go.
Go where?
Pineville. Let's head for Pineville.
Pineville, south. I don't go south.
Nice little girl in Pineville. If she's still there, we get this broke. Now, come on.
And then what? I'm a strange colored man in a white south town. How long you think before they pick me up?
Get off my back. I ain't married to you. Now, what do I care? Come on.
You married to me, all right, Joker. And here's the ring. But I ain't going south on no honeymoon now. We going north.
That was Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis in The Defiant Ones, 1958. What do you think? Does Hollywood break down stereotypes ultimately or endlessly reinforce them? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Scott is on the line. Welcome, Scott. You're on the air.
I'm glad you asked that question about the stereotypes, because my feeling is that the same horrible stereotypes from the 30s are still being perpetrated in A-budget films like Evolution, where David Duchovny is an academic who cares about science, and his mm-hmm. partner, who's also an academic, only cares about meeting girls. And when he gets bitten by an alien, he does the whole eye-rolling thing and the screaming, you know, the whole screaming eye-rolling thing. And then where Chris Tucker, in the Rush Hour films, is, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of just step and fetch it with a little bit of kung fu thrown in. But, what appalls me as much as the movies is the fact that so few people comment on it, that it's sort of accepted on an ongoing basis.
We just go with that flow, you're saying, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, except for maybe Elvis Mitchell, I rarely read a critic who even calls Hollywood on this stuff.
Jesse Rhines, let's put Scott's point to you, and it really does come back again and again to this question of how far have we come, or is it possible that we've actually moved, but there's retrogression that's always popping up?
Yeah, I think that you're always going to regress to some extent, but we should keep in mind that, as Scott said, he's talking about films that are put out by the major industries. Mm-hmm. And this notion of the separation between independent and studio films, major mm-hmm. studio films, is important, because it wasn't until the Paramount Consent Decree in 1948 when the companies, major companies, had to sell their theaters, allow actors, allow directors to go out and act independently, that you started getting salutary depictions of black characters. Mm-hmm. It was a structural change in the film industry that allowed that to happen. And that's still what you're seeing. You're still seeing that it's the independent people who are trying to challenge the stereotypes. Hollywood, of course, is still wedded to what has been shown to be appreciated by the larger American audience, which is, in fact, stereotypical depictions of African Americans.
And is that just profit-seeking, Jesse Rines, or is that racism? Or is it both?
I think it's both. I think, you know, like the people who are writing these films frequently are white. There are increasing number of Ivy Leaguers who have gone out to Hollywood rather than go to Wall Street as they did years ago. Mm-hmm. And they are having a significant influence on this. I do not know whether or not they get good training in their universities. For instance, I think it's important that universities begin to have cultural requirements for students where they force students actually to know about other cultures, at least ones in America, that they mm-hmm. think about the way that these cultures have been depicted. Where I did my doctorate at Berkeley, mm-hmm. there is an American cultures requirement, and you have to take courses that show you another course in order to, another people in order to graduate. You have to deal with those kinds of issues.
And you're saying, Jesse Rines, if they don't know it by the time they get to Hollywood, they're not going to learn it there.
No, they will not learn it there. There's almost no doubt that they will not learn it there.
Garen Daly? I'm sorry, Jesse.
No, you can go on.
Well, Jesse, I actually agree with you on most of that, but there have been some notable exceptions to that. And I would point out to the film that came out last year, Save the Last Dance, which is Julia Stiles and playing and Sean Patrick Thomas, who are playing a white girl and a black boy who end up getting together. And that kind of broke some stereotypes. And it surprised everyone because it was a small film from the studios that did extremely well at the box office. It was almost a Romeo and Juliet effect.
Maybe we're coming to some tipping point here. Jesse Rines mentioned earlier that independents have often led the way here, that the studios haven't generally been at the forefront. And, of course, Spike Lee had a lot of prominence in that independence movement, Garen Daly.
He had an incredible amount of prominence in that. And in the Do the Right Thing, he ended up bringing a lot of the themes that were percolating in the urban environment all together in one film.
This is 1989, set in New York.
Set in New York. And, you know, it's all about guys, you know, struggling to find out what's going on and trying to stake their own territory in the city.
Let's hear a little bit from Spike Lee's 1989 film, Do the Right Thing.
Hey, Sal, how come you're getting the brothers on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Take it easy,
huh? And you, hey, don't stop with me today.
What? Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
Are you a troublemaker? Is that what you are?
You making trouble? Yeah, I'm a troublemaker. I'm making trouble.
Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Garen Daly, how unusual is or was this movie in going right at the raw racial relations, you know, right down where they're really rough?
I think what I liked about it was, first of all, on one side you have the Italian-American who is very, very proud of his heritage, and then you have African-American, actually I thought struggling to come to grips with what his heritage really was, and was just trying to push it out at the Italian-American that he had to respond to his heritage.
And Jesse Rines, was that a breakthrough film in your mind, or is it just when more Americans came to see that kind of film?
I don't know if I would say that it's a break film. I think that it is certainly an important film. It did not create a string. It didn't initiate a string of films that challenged the American political and economic system, as one might hope. I think that his original She's Gotta Have It did that because it did show whites that it was possible to get a middle-class black audience, which they did not think was possible until She's Gotta Have It came out.
You know, Jesse, the other thing that I liked about She's Gotta Have It, it showed an African-American woman with a very full and active sex life. That was a stereotypical breakthrough, I thought.
as opposed to carrying a handbag.
Being a mammy, being a maid, being, you know, some sort of, you know, helping person. This is, she stood on her own as an individual and had an active sexual life.
Of course, Spike Lee. Jesse, please.
That's one of the things that Spike says, that, you know, like, you never saw black people in a sexual relationship, even in a romantic relationship, really, on television. And that's one of the reasons that, that he made Nola have a significant sex life. But also, he did a lot of research to create Nola's character. She was a composite of many women he had actually interviewed, done interviews and questionnaires with to find out how they approached their sexuality.
Of course, then in 1991, Spike Lee brought on Jungle Fever. Wesley Snipes, here's a clip where Wesley Snipes has brought his white date to an upscale African-American restaurant where the waitress, Queen Latifah, is playing this role, is reluctant to serve the couple because this is a mixed-race couple.
Look, you can take my order. Matter of fact, you could have taken my order 30 minutes ago when I sat my black ass in this chair.
Your order.
Excuse me. Do you have a problem?
Yes, I do have a problem, to be honest with you. You fake, tired brothers like you coming in here, that's so typical. I can't even believe you brought her stringy hair ass up here to eat.
Oh, let me tell you something. First of all, Miss Al Sharpton,
Why don't you parade your wife in here somewhere else? Okay?
It's not your business. You are a waitress. Your job is to wait.
Today's specials are the Maryland crab cakes, Creole shrimp gumbo, and blackened catfish. I suggest you have a blackened catfish.
Well, first of all, you Miss Al Sharpton, that's Wesley Snipes and Queen Latifah in Jungle Fever, and that created quite a buzz. But of course, the depiction of cross-racial line sexuality there was very explicit, and this was not at all typical.
Well, it's not only not typical, but it was also based on a true event that occurred in New York. But, you know, with Spike, he was actually following on a bit of a thing that was going on previously. You know, believe it or not, Blazing Saddles broke some of the black-white romance where Cleavon Little and Madeline Kahn ended up having. I mean, we don't think about it because it's a comedy, but it was there. You know, a number of Mississippi Masala, again, with Denzel Washington. So we in the 90s, we started seeing more and more interracial relationships that were substantial.
Garen Daly, Jesse Ryan, stand by. I want to bring in now Audrey McCluskey. She's associate professor at the Department of Afro-American Studies and director of the Black Film Center at Indiana University. Good evening and welcome, Audrey McCluskey.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Audrey, you've come in just when things are getting hot. We just talked about Jungle Fever, and throughout the conversation, we come back to this issue of cross-racial line sexuality. Of course, it comes up this year again as well. Halle Berry in Monsters Ball with Billy Bob Thornton, and the story there, you've got the prison warden or guard executioner who ends up in a relationship with an executed black prisoner's wife. Is this groundbreaking, Audrey McCluskey?
Well, yes and no. It still shows a black woman in a very highly sexualized role.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that Halle Berry's performance was able to move it beyond stereotype. She just gives a tour de force in her performance.
Mm.
And I think that really makes it less or more than a stereotypical role. I think it was a little problematic in the relationship between herself and her husband, which was not explicated very well in the film. And that, I think, adds some tension to the role. But it was a breakthrough in some ways, but it's still the sexualized black woman.
Audrey McCluskey, do you feel, are we making progress toward a time when we won't have to talk about these things as breakthrough or not breakthrough? Is there an American generation coming up that's going to be able to see this, to not just see skin color first in actors, and maybe people don't already, and instead see relationships, and where race won't be the first issue in line? Are we getting near that? Are we there?
Well, I should ask the question of whether our society is getting there, because I think the films will just portray what's happening in our society, actually.
Well, let me still ask the question in that case, and you can speak to both of those.
I think no. Luckily, however, Hollywood is not the only barometer to measure this. I think, as has been said before earlier about the breakthroughs that we can see in independent film, I'm much more hopeful a breakthrough there than I am in the larger Hollywood-driven market.
Mm-hmm. Audrey McCluskey, stand by. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Bill.
Yes, I recently saw
a retrospective on Arts and Entertainment on Denzel Washington and his movie career. Interspaced between the cuts of films were interviews with academics, other actors, directors, and one of the women who was an academic said that she was very proud of Denzel Washington because he had never had an interracial romance on screen, and she saw it as a point of pride. Mm-hmm. And after hearing this, I was extremely upset, and all I could think of was Martin Luther King saying that someday he hoped that people could be judged by the content of their character. Mm. Well, she's also, color of their skin.
She's also wrong, because in Mississippi Masala, he had a relationship with an Indian woman.
I'm just telling you what the woman said, and she saw it as a point of pride and thought that it was a great thing that a brother like him wasn't going to have no love scenes with white women.
Bill, thank you for your call. Jesse, is that you?
Yeah.
Jesse Ryan.
I think that it's really important for that we not make romance between black people and white people the mm-hmm. standard by which we judge our progress. I mean, black people have never had a problem with interracial relations. That's white people's problem. Mm-hmm. And it would be good if they would get over that. I think that it's really important for us to note that color, you know, recognizing people's color is an important thing to do. I am not, and I don't think that black people want a colorblind society. I personally mm-hmm. enjoy the colors that people, I enjoy the differences in people. So I'm not looking for people to discount it. I think that the thing that people want to do is they don't want to be treated badly because of their color. There
Absolutely.
Are other things that are important. And it's not something I think that we have to really fight against. I do think that we need some way for whites in particular to become educated in this. And I think that what the woman was saying about Denzel and celebrating the fact that he did not go along with a white woman is because she is criticizing white society. Mm-hmm. She's not necessarily criticizing the fact that the person is white, but this is a society that has historically betrayed and degraded blacks and has not come to terms with that yet. And as long as they keep on doing that, I think that there are many black people who will not think of the good thing that we associate with them. Unless we fool ourselves.
We hear you loud and clear. Audrey McCluskey, how about Will Smith in Ali? Is this pushing the envelope in any direction, or is this going back to an older kind of image?
Before I answer that, can I comment
Please.
On the previous question?
Please.
I think Denzel Washington has a unique career in Hollywood.
Yes.
I think he's been able to avoid some of the pitfalls that other black actors have had. And I think, actually, like the academic, the woman that he was speaking of, mm-hmm. one of the pitfalls that he's avoided is actually the interracial romance. Because even though we would liberally like to celebrate our openness racially, I think there's a possibility of igniting latent racial fears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his acceptance is in part because he does not do that. He's also, number two, avoided these buddy movies, I think, that kind of sidekick syndrome.
The rush hour stuff.
Mm-hmm. That a lot of black male actors have actually been involved with. Mm-hmm. And so these two things, I think avoiding the interracial romance is a part of his shrewd move in Hollywood, because he is seen as a very authentic black hero, but at the same time, he doesn't ignite those latent racial fears among mm-hmm. whites.
He stayed out of that minefield. We're talking about blacks in film, three up for top of Academy Awards this year. Does Hollywood break down stereotypes or endlessly reinforce them? Are black actors still black first and actors second? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about black Americans in film in America today. Do three Black Academy Award nominations in 1 year mean it's a new day? Or is it an outrage that it's been 40 years since Best Actor or Actress went to a black actor or actress? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We were talking before about Halle Berry and Monsters Ball. Let's listen to just a clip of that before we even go on here. Billy Bob Thornton gives his lover, Halle Berry, his son's car.
I can't take this.
As my son's, it'd mean a lot to him. I'm sure he'd want it that way. He'd want somebody to have it to get some use out of it.
Well, I ain't saying I don't want it. I just can't take it.
Well, I want you to have it. I really do. It'd mean a lot to me. Let's just take it for a little spin.
I ain't even got my shoes on.
That's all right. We won't go far. Let's go. Come on. Let's see how it drives.
Billy Bob Thornton and Academy Award nominee Halle Berry in Monsters Ball. Audrey McCluskey, what do you see in Halle Berry's acting? What does it tell us about where black women may be going in American film?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't tell us very much because there are so few opportunities for black women. In fact, I call black women the invisible people in Hollywood.
Well, there's the point, maybe, isn't it?
It is. And so Halle Berry, we can certainly applaud her magnificent performance, and I hope that she wins. But I don't know whether that's going to create the kind of climate. It certainly can't hurt it, but to create a kind of climate where black female characters have an even shot in Hollywood.
Why do you think it's been harder for black female actors?
I think one reason is the new multiculturalism. And we have a broader definition of what we used to call the other or the exotic. And so roles that black women used to get, now they have to be shared with other women of color.
Is it just sharing, or do you think there's even a prejudice toward other women of color?
Perhaps even a prejudice.
And why would that be?
The more exotic. I think it's still looking for the exotic, the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more exotic, the better. But the roles haven't changed. The opportunities haven't changed. They've just been constricted to this very narrow scope.
Audrey McCluskey, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Audrey McCluskey is Associate Professor at the Department of Afro-American Studies and Director of the Black Film Center at Indiana University. We've got calls we want to try and get in here. Sarev is on the line. Welcome, Sarev. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I wanted to make a point about a very favorite actor of mine called Morgan Freeman.
Sure.
I want to talk about the movie Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
In the Stephen King short story, the character that Morgan Freeman plays in the movie is actually a white character. It's called Red, and he's supposed to be Irish. And in the movie, he jokes about it. And when Tim Robbins asks him, like, why do they call you Red? He says, maybe because I'm Irish. So my point being that role lost none of its significance by a black actor playing it.
In fact, having never read the book, it seems a very powerful role to me.
Yeah, it's a very powerful. So my point being that we have been talking about black actors and white actors and their roles in Hollywood. To my knowledge, maybe it's an outsider's view, me not being American, is that the directors take actors, not exactly black or white, and there have been some great actors on both sides.
And here's a case where Morgan Freeman played that because he was the best actor for the role.
For that role, and he brought that role out to life.
Mm-hmm. And it also made the film a little better when he did exactly that scene, because it makes you smile. It makes you smile, and it makes the film better.
Maybe because I'm Ira Sarev. Thanks so much for your call. Pat's on the line. Welcome, Pat. You're on the air. Hello, Pat. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. You were speaking earlier about breakthrough roles for blacks in film. What I'd consider a breakthrough is to see black men and women portrayed in healthy, normal relationships on a regular basis. You never see that. Yes, we're seeing, you know, black women with white men with, you know, in reference to Halle Berry's role and vice versa in Jungle Fever. But what about black men and women in healthy relationships? That, to me, would be a breakthrough. I'd like to see more blacks that are more representative of what I'm used to.
We hear you loud and clear. Can you think of any example of that, Pat, that comes to mind?
John Q.
John Q. Jesse Rines, you put it in that category?
I think that they have a very healthy relationship. It's just their son is in big trouble, and they have to deal with that. But
right,
I do
but
think that
not, it doesn't seem like there are very many of those type roles for blacks.
Once
we can maybe find that as a norm, then that to me would be a breakthrough.
The problem that I see with that is that the economics are not there. Hollywood is putting up, you know, $30, $40, $50 million to make a film. You got to double that gross before they make their money back. Then you throw in the advertising, the publicity. You're looking at $100 million, and you know the people in Hollywood are going to say to themselves, it's just not there.
But, Garen Daly, To Pat's point, there are films in which white couples, they're big-budget films, and the white couples are not necessarily in some freakish roles. They're relatively normal relationships. They're always, of course, in abnormal circumstances. Why not blacks in that situation?
I agree. I would like to see more roles like that. I just don't see Hollywood getting beyond its prejudice and looking at the country as a whole. I mean, one of the things that they're not even looking at is that 30% of the moviegoers are non-white, yet they're not addressing that at all. Really missing the boat.
Pat, thank you very much for that call. Jesse Rines, what about this issue of the economics of film? Does it put us in some kind of permanently crimped posture, or is it surmountable?
Well, it certainly puts us in a crimped posture because, in fact, Hollywood's budget is based upon the predilections of the American public. And if they don't like a particular role because they don't go to see those kinds of films, they don't pay their money, then Hollywood is going to be really reluctant to make those roles. But let me say something real quick about the film Monster Ball. Mm-hmm. I have to agree with Ms. McCluskey that Halle Berry's over-sexualized role was rather insulting and shocking. I mean, it was very... She played it well. I agree.
Right.
However, as my mother said, she's getting tired of, if there is an interracial relationship, that the black woman has to be the one demanding the sex and showing that she's basically a whore. That is a film that really demonstrates paternalism on the part of whites because, again, we have this white guy coming in. Even though he executed her husband, we don't know why her husband was in jail
right.
yet, as far as I know.
And he's the prison authority.
He's the prison authority, and then he comes in and makes everything right for Halle Berry.
Yeah,
it's like,
that.
You know, like the paternalism is ridiculous in the film.
But Jesse, he's also trying to make it right for himself, too. He's atoning, and I think that atonement is part of the thing. And I think the other thing that I would like to say about the film is that the ugliness of the Peter Boyle character when Halle Berry faces him is really repugnant. And it's really powerful.
By contrast, I guess Billy Bob Thornton looks good, but still, we take your point, Jesse Rines. Our time is almost out. Jesse Rines, we want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Jesse Rines teaches political economy in the African-American and African Studies Department at Rutgers University. He's author of Black Film, White Money. And Garen Daly, our on-point resident movie expert, owner of Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, as always.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
Don't own oil and
gas production. I appreciate that you don't agree with this. I'm not asking you.
Senator, you have asked me a very specific question.
The remote Panchisi Gorge in northeast Georgia is a lawless place out of control of the central government. Now the U.S. is ready to help the Georgian military clean it up, opening a new front in the war on terrorism.
It is not a group of only extremist Pakistani. It is a vast and international network of terrorists. You know, wherever there's misery, they'll find people. And there's misery in other parts of the world.
From the heart of the Islamic world and from the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, a promise to Israelis. The Arab world would recognize Israel if Israel withdraws from the land it occupied in 1967, including East Jerusalem.
Now that we're in this national crisis of security, the last thing they want is for us to emphasize that there's still major problems. We're still engaged in a facade of security as we were before September 11th.
At breakfast this morning, 100 of the detainees refused a meal. After a few of them, apparently only a couple of dozen of them, refused dinner last night, so it has spread rapidly overnight.
Today, open warfare broke out here. Muslims and Hindus were locked in a pitched battle, seizing whatever weapons they could find.
I think the Republicans' reaction is nothing short of hysterical. The Congress has a constitutional responsibility to ask questions. We are not a rubber stamp to this president or to anybody else.
Well, the people who are living and working in these underground bunkers are top career officials mainly. These shadow governors arrived there and found computers that were several generations behind and incapable of accessing current databases. I'm surprised it hasn't leaked before now. You're talking about more than 200 people altogether since September 11th who vanished from their families for periods of time.
Another week that was, with Enron executives in Congress, U.S. troops headed to Georgia, Daniel Pearl's widow, Marianne, talking after her husband's, or word of her husband's tragic death. Saudi Arabia's peace offer, FAA employees blowing the whistle, the Guantanamo detainees going on a hunger strike, and the bunker government, Jack Beatty, cavalcade goes on.
We're in the bunker.
You sound like it tonight, Jack.
A little off the news. There's some good news for California Gray Davis and possibly a preview of the presidential race of 2000. Richard Reardon, the former mayor of Los Angeles, is lagging in the polls for Tuesday's GOP primary for governor. He looked to be Davis's strongest competition. Davis even took out 8 million in attack ads against him to keep
unprecedented
him off
in a primary.
Unprecedented in a primary of the other party.
How do you interpret all that, Jack?
Well, and there's another gain for him. Also helping Davis is news that Enron may have manipulated the energy market during California's energy crunch. This could take him off the hook for his handling of the crisis. If reelected, he'd be near the top of the short list of Democratic contenders. He'd be the first Roman Catholic presidential nominee since John F. Kennedy, the third Californian to be nominated since 1960, the second Vietnam veteran after Al Gore, and possibly the blandest presidential candidate in history.
So is this your challenger to George W. Bush, Jack Beatty?
Well, he would be a very bland challenger indeed, but he has 54 electoral votes in his pocket, and no other contender could have that.
But does he know how to say, let's roll?
That's to be seen. George Bush is preparing for the election. Steel workers demonstrated a few hundred yards from his office, where he's close to a decision on whether to protect the steel industry with tariffs, perhaps up to 40% on imported steel. He won the election, you could argue, by carrying West Virginia, where he promised he'd act on steel. Gore lost it because the Clinton administration refused to help the industry. Free trade cost Gore the presidency. If Bush listens to his political advisor, Karl Rove, he won't let that ideology stop him doing what it takes to win West Virginia again and perhaps capture Pennsylvania.
The head of that union was making some very persuasive, or at least rhetorically well-put comments today on how the United States was the world's patsy for taking all this subsidized steel. But it does go against even the Republican line in a pretty strong way, doesn't it, Jack?
It sure does, but I think this is one where Karl Rove is going to win at least part of it. The steel workers were also asking for the government to sort of take over their pensions from the steel industry. Mm-hmm. I don't think they'll do that, but Rove wants him to do something on the tariffs. Unfortunately, for the steel workers' argument, imports have actually been going down in recent years. So we'll have to see. And bad news for serious journalism. ABC's reportedly ready to end Nightline's run as the best in the business.
Why is that, Jack? Have they explained what's behind that?
Well, you know, apparently their audience is about the same size as Leno and Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. It's the wrong composition. It's too old. They're not the people the advertisers want. So they want Ted to leave, and this is really something. It comes just after a study of media coverage of the war found that Nightline had more facts, less bloviation, and featured more criticism of the administration than any other news show on TV. PBS's NewsHour with Jim, I don't vote because I want to remain objective, Lara, was the show least critical of the administration.
Is it a final decision yet, Jack Beatty, on Nightline, or do we know?
We don't know, but it looks pretty bad, and apparently the Nightline staff was the first to hear it. Heard it from the New York Times first today, which is quite a shock.
I guess On Point has showed up just in time. And Jack Beatty, Vice President Cheney, after all these months we've been asking, where is he? And now we know. He's in the bunker.
He's in the bunker. And he's going to stay there as the GEO pursues him to get news on who met with him about the energy plan.
Yeah, he's not going to come out until the court battle blows over. But it is something, isn't it, that the thought that all these months after 9/11, we still have the backup crew in the bunker, including the vice president, much of the time.
Yeah. As we see headlines, Al-Qaeda prepares its second punch.
Yeah, and the Washington Post is saying today that it's the nuclear threat that keeps them there. And
it's a
frightening thought to
it
think
really
that
is.
The government still feels that so acutely. Jack, have a great weekend.
And you and our listeners, too.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.